Happy Labor Day, everybody. I'm a little tired today because yesterday was spent in great labor at our house. I'll talk more about that in a moment. But when I was kind of like trying to piece together some notes to give the talk today, I suddenly realized I had no idea about Labor Day. I never was taught why and how Labor Day came about in Canada. And I thought that was rather odd. So I went back and, of course, went to Wikipedia to find out about Labor Day. And maybe you guys all know about it. Maybe it's just me. But Labor Day actually is a very old holiday in Canada. And its roots lie in a strike, of course, as we can imagine, in Toronto, a printer's strike, way back in 1872. And they were fighting tooth and nail for a 9-hour workday, when at that time, the standard was 12 hours a day. You mention that 12 hours a day was the standard work day, and they were fighting for 9. And of course, the various companies, including the printer company, but other companies as well, were totally against this, because this would allow for leisure time, and work was a virtue, leisure was a vice, as it was understood in those days, right? Good Protestant ethic of, you know, you spend all your waking hours basically nose to the grindstone. And was actually John A. Macdonald, right, the first Prime Minister of Canada, who realized he could use this as an opportunity to get a kind of advantage over his current rival at that time. His rival who supported the owners of the big companies, because that's where his political capital was coming from. And so John A. Macdonald supported the labor unions, and he was successful. And I think it was 1874, we had a 9-hour day instead of a 12-hour day here.
Did it say what the work week was?
I can't remember what the work week was. I didn't actually look for that. I don't know if it was like a 6-day work week or a 5.5-day work week. So the Toronto printers were kind of the pioneers of the shorter work week in all of North America. This is where it started. And then the campaign heated up for an 8-hour work week.
Day.
A day. It'd be nice to have an 8-hour work week, but 8-hour day. And eventually that took hold both in Canada and the United States. So we seem to be stuck there, more or less. Or sometimes that seems to be increasing, like, you know, with the tech industry and lawyers and stuff. Yeah. So Labor Day, the first Monday of every September, has been a statutory holiday in Canada since 1894. So it's kind of an old holiday. And historically, this was a time of great celebration when workers would mark the day with all kinds of, you know, activities like picnics and parades and speeches and games and amateur athletic competitions. The idea being, of course, to promote solidarity of the working class. And this was a time when Canada, along with much of the other England and the States, was involved in rapid industrializations. It's kind of sad today. What do we do? We just enjoy the holiday with our family. That's not sad, but... But where are all the amateur athletic competitions? You know, we could all be out there, you know, having three-legged races and enjoying ourselves like that. So after I read that, I kind of wondered, then what about work? And where does the word work actually come from? And the word work comes, it's a very old word, not in English though. It's from what they call the Proto-Indian-European group of languages. So work is an old word. It's and the original was werg, W-E-R-G, something like that. And it simply meant something to be done, something to do. That was the original meaning of it. And then it wasn't until about 1200 when it came into the English language, meaning physical exertion or scholarly labor or artistic labor. All of those things came in at once. So yesterday, at the Blue Mountain Zendo, where Kate and I live, we celebrated Labor Day a little bit early by working around the gardens out there, stacking wood, weeding, renovating the compost bins, cutting brush, picking crab apples, which we brought some to share with people here, picking beans, preparing food, of course, and enjoying ourselves. And much work was done, and Kate and I are very, very grateful because it gives us a tremendous boost as we enter into fall. And of course, it wasn't just work that happened there. We started with some Zazen practice, and we enjoyed good food together. And we had a chance to hang out as we worked and during breaks. And this is, I think, the fifth time we've done this up at Blue Mountain. And in truth, I have to say, I'm always hesitant, or perhaps maybe even reluctant, to ask others to come out and work at our place. But each time, including this time, during the day, when I see what's going on, I remember that work brings us together and helps to make us into a sangha. Sessions and retreats, of course, are very powerful and they're very important for our practice. But it's different. It's a little bit different when we gather together, the sangha members, and work and eat together. I can't say that working together is more special, only that it brings forward a different facet of practice. I think it brings forth qualities like generosity, kindness, patience. So it's really valuable. And this has been acknowledged, you know, always in the Zen tradition, the value of work. Zen, as we most of us know here, has a long tradition of really valuing work or labor, going all the way back to its kind of misty beginnings. Baijiang, who was a Chinese Zen teacher who lived during the Tang Dynasty, and even today is really deeply valued within the Zen tradition as a source of spiritual authority and inspiration. And I would say he remains one of the most recognized Zen teachers, Chinese Zen teachers, today in the lineage. And so he lived around, for those of you who are not familiar with the Tang Dynasty, he lived around mid-700s to the early 800s AD. Now, Baijiang is also given a special acknowledgement because he established the Zen monastic rule. All those rules we kind of follow within the Zendo today, and particularly if you go and stay in a monastery. So he created, at least he's given the credit for, creating a new pattern of monastic life in China, and now Japan, Korea here. And he's considered to have developed the first independent Zen monastery ever. Before then, people practiced together. Different groups, different schools practiced together. So he's given that accolade as well as having established the first Zen monastery. And what's unique about that is that he included periods of hard work and farming. Something that in India, particularly, was not acceptable. Not acceptable in Buddhist monasticism. Monks were to beg for their food, go from door to door and ask for their food. And they didn't farm, and they didn't do any kind of really heavy labor. But Baijiang turned that on its head and said, we must work for ourselves. We must be self-sufficient. And in a sense, that was a saving grace for Zen Buddhism, or Chan Buddhism, as it's known in Chinese. Because during periods of oppression, when Buddhism was oppressed in China, particularly by the Confucian establishment, the fact that the Zen monasteries were off in the mountains and pretty self-sufficient actually saved them. And so there were schools in China that it became extinct because of that oppression. So anyway, that's a long kind of rambling introduction to Baijiang. To get to the point I really want to get to. So here's a story about Baijiang and work. Baijiang was always very insistent that on working every day himself. And when he was old, he persisted in this. And the monks that he taught and shared the monastery with him felt very sorry for him. This old man, probably quite arthritic, getting up every day and heading out to the garden to hoe. And so they hid his tools. And he looked around for them, couldn't find them anywhere. Nobody would tell him where they were. And so he said to the assembly, "I have no virtue. Why should others work for me?" And he refused to eat. And he then said, famously, "A day of no work is a day of no eating." And so his monks, kind of realizing their error, quickly returned his tools to him and let him totter out into the garden again to do whatever he could do. So this saying, "A day of no work is a day of no eating," became very famous in Zen circles. And today, or perhaps I should say even to this day, all the Zen schools, both Korea, Japan, and in Japan, are noted for the practice of work. And I like this story. I really like this story about Baijiang because it tells us about a greater understanding of what work is, the centrality of work within life. Unlike today's focus on kind of leisure and entertainment, how fast can I get this done so I can hit Netflix or, go boating or whatever. Baijiang saw that work as completely intimate, woven into the human condition. I think Baijiang understood that we must work, otherwise we can't be fully who we are. We are workers. There's one more story about Baijiang that really illustrates another aspect of this work and practice. So once another famous Zen teacher, actually, Yunyan, asked Baijiang, "Every day there is hard work to do. Who do you do it for?" Every day there is hard work to do. Who do you do it for? And Bai Zhang replied, "There is someone who requires it." Isn't that an interesting answer? There is someone who requires it. So Yunyan then said to Bai Zhang, "Well, why not have him do it himself?" And Bai Zhang says, "He has no tools. He has no tools." Now, this lovely story, so powerful and moving, is, I think, Bai Zhang telling us about a kind of inner work, an inner work that happens in each of us, both on the cushion and off the cushion. Every day there is hard work to do. Of course, there are many kinds of work or labor, right? Just keeping ourselves alive requires work. Preparing food, cleaning, keeping warm, getting dressed. There's work for livelihood, the work to raise children, work to care for a parent, perhaps an aging parent, care for a sick spouse, a friend. Now, our kind of typical modern view is that we have times when we work and times when we have leisure. But from the Zen point of view, from Bai Zhang's point of view, that's not quite right. Our practice is to meet each moment fully. Sometimes we need to be active. We need to use our hands, mouth, legs, body. And sometimes we rest. So rather than a work time and a leisure time, there is simply just life time. Just life time. Each moment to be met fully. Each moment to express ourselves with dignity. And when we do this, doesn't there arise kind of a sense of kind of integrity and fulfillment? Just meeting this moment. So let's go back for a moment to the exchange between Yunyan and Bai Zhang. Every day there is hard work to do. Who do you do it for? Interesting question. This is a deep koan to ask. Who do you do it for? And Bai Zhang's reply, of course, is there is someone who requires it. Who requires your hard work? On one level, we may say, well, I need it. I need to do it. Or we may say, you know, my friend, my spouse, my family, I do it, you know, I need to work for them. And I think that's partly true, of course. That's certainly the story we tell ourselves. But on another level, as Bai Zhang implies, a life itself calls to us to use our life, to use this body. Life itself calls us to offer ourselves. When I watch animals work, not that I've seen a lot, but I've seen, like, you know, dogs herding sheep and read about it, or dogs in trials doing their work, or horses, you know, working on ranches. I'm often struck by what I really believe is genuine cooperation. The animals work because they're offering their life. This is part of what it means to be alive. Something requires us, both animal and human, to fully express ourselves in whatever our task is. And there's great joy, right, in when we really enter into work. I said, you know, life itself calls us to offer ourselves, but maybe that's not quite right. I'm not quite sure how to put it. Yet, our hands, our legs, eyes, mouth, ears, our whole body are the very tools for life to express herself. And I think animals know this very deeply, perhaps much more than we typically do. So Baijiang is telling us, in this sense, he does not work to make a living or to get as much done as possible or to get promoted, but out of love for the job itself, the love for someone who requires it, the intimacy with someone who requires it. And when we enter into work with this kind of effort, so rich and free of critical thoughts, don't we just kind of flow with the task? You know, there's sometimes when I wash dishes and I do so with a kind of... right? And then there's sometimes I wash dishes and I'm just kind of enjoying it. The smell of the lavender soap that I insist on buying. Yeah. And just watching things get clean. Working hard for the one who requires it. You know, thinking about this and thinking about, you know, what various things Baijiang has said, perhaps we could say we are born to work. In that great sense of work. Baijiang also clearly understood that there's no difference between work and meditation practice in the monastery, right? Work as practice means, of course, paying really careful attention to what's happening right now. Being really mindful of digging in the garden, stacking wood or pulling weeds, staying really present in this moment. And we can do this when we do physical labor quite effectively, pretty easily, by being aware of our hands and feet or how our tools move or the rhythm of our movements in the work. It's a little harder, of course, when you're sitting on a computer tapping away. I agree. But nevertheless, working in the garden or working in the zendo or working in the kitchen and sitting zazen are not so different. Here, now, be in this body, be in this moment, return again and again. And we let go. We let go of thoughts of our goals. We let go of thoughts of doing it perfectly. So far beyond thinking about completing a task or seeing it through to the finish, when work is engaged just as practice, it's seen as part of our meditation. Work is an end in itself. Not the accomplishment of work, but just the being there, fully engaged in whatever the work is. So work and zazen and the Zen tradition have gone hand in hand from the very beginning, and both are necessary. It's clearly understood, without one, the other will suffer. If we think we can just sit on our butts all the time and not have to work, you'll get whacked by the Zen teacher. That's just not how it works. It's not so much about what we are doing, it's really about how we're doing it. Are we there or not? Suzuki Roshi, the Japanese Zen teacher who brought this form of practice from Japan to North America, said this: when you do something, you should burn yourself up completely like a good bonfire and leave no trace of yourself. Work. there's another way of looking at work. And I'm going to read you a little passage to give us a little slightly different take on work. And this is looking at our whole life as a work. Perhaps as a work of art, or a work of compassion, or a work of deep gratitude. Anyway, here's, I want to read you this little, just the opening piece here from this book, A Whole Life's Work by a Zen teacher and practitioner, Lewis Richmond. So he writes this. So when we ask, what is the work of a human being, what definition shall we use? Is our life working? Is it rather than fun work? Are we working our life like a Gordian knot that we don't know how to untie? Are we worked up about our life? Or do we just go about it day by day hoping for the best? Or suppose we go deeper and ask, of all the kinds of work we do, what is our most important work? What are we doing here in this world anyway, where each one of us arrives naked and helpless with no map or compass, like a trainee in some cosmic outward bound program? Are we, as we struggle to get up our arms around these questions, there are two things we should know for certain. Today, we are here, and someday, sometime, we will be gone. Today, we are here, and someday, sometime, we will be gone. During our time on this planet, what will you do? What is your responsibility? Responsibility to yourself, to your family and friends, to community, to nation, to all peoples, and the innumerable creatures that inhabit the earth, sea, and sky. Do we have responsibility for any of it? Or is it beyond our power? What do you say? How will you act? In other words, what is your whole life's work? What is your whole life's work? So I ask you, when will you begin your whole life's work? And what is the real work of your life? Maybe this week we can ask ourselves. And just to help us with that question, I'd like to end with a poem by Wendell Berry, American poet, one of my favorite poets. And he has a really interesting message for us about work. It's called The Real Work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Thank you.
Amen.